All right. I've never had the first Friday night of the term before. Anyway, here we are. My title tonight is Staying at the Table, the Humanness of Spirituality. In 1955, Francis and Edith Schaeffer were living in Switzerland with their family as missionaries to a post-World War II Europe. At the time, they decided to remain in Switzerland, but to leave their mission-sending organization in order to start LaBrie, the shelter. The story of how LaBrie came to be is a long and fascinating one that I won't have time to tell today. Marty Kies actually did a great lecture for us last time on the history of LaBrie that's on our online database if you're interested in checking that out. But one of the things that led the Schaeffers to start LaBrie was a desire to provide a place where the Christian faith was not only talked about and discussed at an intellectual level, but a place that would be where it would be lived out in a moment-by-moment way as well. That LaBrie would be a demonstration of the reality of God, a living apologetic that could stand as testament to the truth of the Christian faith, truth with a capital T, that was real, not because somebody liked the feel of it, but because it was consistent with the reality of life. We do our best to continue to live this out at LaBrie in our shared lives here together through meals, work, study, play, teaching, and rest. We try to live in a way that is embodied, that honors and reflects what it is to be human. And we spend a lot of time at LaBrie talking about what it means to be human. Doing life with people night and day, literally, makes it a very hard topic to avoid. As is often the case with LaBrie lectures, we have to pick a title for publicity's sake before we actually write the lectures. So if you'll give me some liberty with this, I'm actually going to work backwards through my title and start with the idea of the humanness of spirituality, and we'll get to the table in a few minutes. But first, I want to talk about what it means to be human. We get conflicting messages on this from a variety of places. The culture around us says that our identity, or what makes us human, comes from the things of this world. But even those messages are inconsistent. In the West, we live in a success-driven culture that tells us that our vocational accomplishments are what define us. Yet even within that, there's one camp that says that a narrow, linear formula is the recipe for career success, while another touts the merits of breaking the mold in achieving success on your own terms. The advertising industry would have us believe that the way our bodies look and an active sex life are what makes us human. Except somehow the message that they project is that sex is the most important thing, but it's also the least important thing. We're expected to marry, have children, settle down, because that's what people do. But others balk at the idea of long-term commitment and fidelity in relationships and see that as a limit to the freedom that is truly the capstone of human flourishing. Or, more simply, as one of our students said this week at breakfast, without coffee, I stop being human. So that might resonate more than anything else with you. Unfortunately, the church is not always much more helpful in addressing this question. Several months ago, I did a lecture here at LaBrie on the topic of longing and desire. In preparation, I took a very informal poll of some of my friends as well as our LaBrie students. Of all the people I talked to who had grown up in the church in some way, shape, or form, they all had a negative connotation for the word desire. And I heard story after story of people being told in church, whether directly or indirectly, that they could not or should not trust their own desires, ideas, imaginations, etc. There is a significant rift in our thinking between things that are sacred and things that are secular. Much of this thinking stems back to the teachings of Plato, who lived and wrote several hundred years before the life of Christ and the birth of the early church. Two former LaBrie workers, Jerem Bars and Randall McCauley, have done some really helpful work in the area of the humanness of spirituality, particularly in their book, Being Human, and I'm leaning heavily on some of their material now. Plato taught that the world was divided into the material realm and the spiritual realm. with the material or physical realm being imperfect, transitory, and shadowy, and the spiritual realm being one of ideas, reality, and permanence. Under the Platonic view, ordinary human experience is meaningless, and the material realm only holds value in so much as it can spark something in the spiritual realm. For example, a flower only has value if you look at it and it directs you to God in some way. It has no value in and of itself. A 3rd century Roman philosopher, Plotinus, took Plato's ideas a step further. He wrote that the way to divine knowledge is, quote, to separate yourself from your body and very earnestly to put aside the system of sense with its desires and impulses and every such futility, end quote. So in his view, we should put aside all things in the material realm in order to devote ourselves to the spiritual realm, which is where true reality and meaning lie. This path of thinking, and many others that evolved out of it, have woven themselves tightly into the DNA of the church in a way that is quite contrary to the Bible. I'm not a historian or a philosopher. I'm far from it. But generations of both have had a profound effect on how we continue to think of ourselves as human beings in this way, both within and outside of the church. One example is the 17th century French philosopher René Descartes, who's known for his famous statement, I think, therefore I am, lending much credence to the idea that humans are primarily thinking things. In his recent book, You Are What You Love, Calvin College philosophy professor Jamie Smith uses the image of a bobblehead doll to illustrate the idea that human beings are just brains on a stick. This is a prominent, deeply held view in our culture and in the church. In case you didn't know what a bobblehead doll was, they're Superman. Though this secular spiritual split has deep roots within church history, it is still alive and well in the church today. This plays out in how we approach every area of life: vocation, relationships, our bodies, sex, food, play, nature, leisure time, and those are just the big ones. It's why Christians often think that it's inherently better to be a pastor rather than a plumber, and why the better thing to do is to spend time in prayer while we let someone else take care of the dirty dishes. It wasn't until I first went to Libri as a student myself that I realized that I held this view as well. I don't remember ever being taught this explicitly, but I was operating out of a place of a real material spiritual divide. I realized that I held the view that my soul was the good, holy part of me, and kind of like a butterfly, it was caged in the prison of my physical body and sinful heart, and not until I died and my physical body was no more that my soul would have the freedom to fly freely. We'll come back to this image in a bit. But this was a major aha moment for me, and I'm still trying to learn what it means to think well in an integrated way about my physical body, my thoughts, my talents, my interests, my ideas, etc. If you've grown up in the church or Christian circles at all, you have likely been well trained to think long and often on your own sin and brokenness. We often hear talk of the Apostle Paul referring to the sins of the flesh, and we can relate. It's easy to fall into the realm of materialism, to believe, whether consciously or not, that our physical humanity is wholly removed from the world of the spiritual, that our sin is what defines us. But this is not the picture that the Bible gives us. It can be hard to define what it really means to be human. I think in our day-to-day lives, we get closest to it when we get to it through the negative way, when humanity seems to be absent or is taken away. Like many of you, I'm guessing, a few Sundays ago, I watched the news stories replaying the events of September 11th, 2001. And like many of you, I can remember exactly where I was that morning 15 years ago when I watched with awe at the images that I saw on the television screen. Not only do I remember where I was, but I remember what I was doing, who I was with, and even what I was wearing. I can recount to you most of the events of my day that day, which I couldn't do for any random day before or since. The history books will tell us that it was and is the greatest terrorist attack committed against human life on American soil. But that's not why we remember. Why are the events of 9/11 so etched in our individual and collective memories? Genesis 1 gives us a clue. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Here is what it means to be human. We are made in bodies, embodied, to bear the image of the living God. We're made to carry our dignity and dominion into the world that he created for us. Our embodied human state is very good. The earth, God's creation, is very good. The food we were given to cultivate and eat is very good. The work we were given to do is very good. In the early chapters of Genesis, we have a picture of a beautiful and lush garden created by God to live in perfect communion with human beings, the crown of his creation. This is why events like 9/11 stop us cold. Because human life has value far beyond someone's role or productivity or bank account or sex life or relational roles. Human life has infinite value because the God of the universe has created us to bear his image on the earth. That is what gives us dignity and worth, and that is what it means to be human. In many ways, this phrase, the humanness of spirituality, is redundant. We are fully human because we are created in the image of God, and all that God has made is spiritual. Those of you who know your Bibles know that just two short chapters later, paradise is lost. When Adam and Eve disobeyed God by eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, their relationship with him was broken. However, the fall really has four main implications. We now have a broken relationship not only with God, but also with other people, with ourselves, and with the natural and created world. In many of our churches, the message of the gospel has been translated to us in such a way that maximizes the need for Jesus for our salvation. That Jesus came to save our souls from the effects of our sin and therefore the judgment of God. This is true, but it's not complete. I mentioned four areas of life that the fall affected, but the focus that I just mentioned talked about and only addresses one of those areas, man's broken relationship with God. And so this is where we need to assess our view of the Bible and even evangelism. As Randall McCauley has said, the Bible does not primarily exist as a rule book for right and wrong, but as a guidebook for human flourishing. The purpose of Christ isn't just to save our souls, but to restore our full humanity, to recover the goodness that was present in the garden. Jesus came in order to recover and restore the image of God in man. 2 Corinthians 3:18 says, "And we, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit." Francis Schaeffer described human beings as glorious ruins. Ruins because we are marred by the fall, but glorious because we bear the image of the Creator God. Many people have the idea that right now humans are only the ruins, that the glory will not come until we meet Jesus again face to face. But that is not the case. Glorious is an apt description for us now, because those who have faith in Christ are being sanctified, changed into the glorious image of Christ. As 2 Corinthians says, transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory. It's an ongoing process. Hans Ruckmacher, who was a well-known art historian and influential in the early days of the Dutch Libri, said this, "Jesus did not come to make us Christians, but to make us more fully human." While we are rightly called to die to self in the sense of our pride and selfishness and to say no to sin, ultimately, the Christian faith affirms the self, and it affirms the worth and dignity that lies in each human being, and of the things that make us us. Rational thought, creativity, talent, personality, ability to use our bodies. My sanctification doesn't mean that I need to transform into a generic version of a Christian, but it means that I will hopefully be transformed into a more Mary Frances version of myself, a version that allows me to reflect and image Jesus in a way that no one else can. And the same goes for you as well. And so with this, salvation is not an escape from the ordinary or the material world. Jesus was very much in the ordinary places of life. This is one reason that the religious elect of his time had so much trouble with him. He did not spend his time following the law to a T or hours on end in the temple. He spent his time on the road, in cities, with tradesmen, prostitutes, widows, children, and the poor, in the homes of unsavory characters. If you pay attention to the miracles of Jesus, you will see that those miracles were not performed for the sake of fame or notoriety for a cause. There was no strategy involved. Jesus did not plot and plan with his disciples over how they could best use their resources to get the biggest bang for their buck in the miracle department, as far as people, visibility, and showmanship were concerned. Time and time again, the result of Jesus' miracles was to restore people back to their regular everyday lives, to restore their humanity. Jesus responded to who and what was right in front of him. He didn't go searching for people who needed a miracle, maybe because he knew that he didn't have to look far for people who needed a miracle. None of us do. He turned water into wine at a wedding so that guests could go on celebrating the bride and groom. He healed the woman who had been bleeding because she was literally just right there. And for the first time in years, she was able to return to her home and community because she was no longer unclean. He brought the daughter of Jairus back to life and then promptly gave her breakfast so that she could get up and go about her day. In his book, A Meal with Jesus, Tim Chester looks to the gospel narratives to answer the following two questions. The first one is, why did Jesus come? To serve, give his life as a ransom, and seek and save the lost. And the second is, how did Jesus come? The Son of Man came eating and drinking. The Bible is full of allusions to meals, food, tables, and gatherings centered around all three. They play an important role in the biblical narrative, in the life of God's people, and in the life of Jesus. Just to mention a few, the lush food growing in the Garden of Eden, the Old Testament food laws, celebratory feast days, years of jubilee, God pouring down manna from heaven, the promised land flowing with milk and honey. And in the New Testament, the miracle of water to wine at the wedding at Cana, the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, the Last Supper, the fruit of the Spirit, and the list goes on and on and on. So this leads me back to the first part of my title, staying at the table. It's hard to do much at Liberty without talking about food. The place where food and the table play probably the most significant role in the Bible is at the Last Supper. Jesus and his disciples are celebrating the Passover feast just hours before Judas' betrayal, Jesus' arrest, and Peter's disowning. Jesus sets a table for the disciples, and they eat together. At the Last Supper, Jesus said, "Do this in remembrance of me." Jesus gave us something to do together to remember him. He could have easily said, read this, or think about this, or memorize this, but he said, do this. When we break bread together, we remember Christ and his bodily sacrifice for us. We remember that his work continues through the body of his church. And we remember that the life we live now is not the final word, but we are preparing for the ultimate meal, which we will share together with one another and with Christ when we meet him in heaven. As the table has been set, the story has been set. I've stolen the first part of my title tonight from Parker Palmer's wonderful essay called On Staying at the Table, where he writes about our vision for Christian community. He reminds us that in addition to the ways that Eden and the New Jerusalem act as models for community, there is a third important place in the Bible where we see real community enacted, the table of the Last Supper. Palmer reminds us that both Eden and the New Jerusalem are pictures of community without sin. While the table of the Last Supper gives us a more realistic picture of what community can and should look like for us right now in the midst of a world riddled with brokenness. Jesus stayed at the table despite the bickering and imminent betrayal. Palmer says this about Jesus. Sorry if you guys can't read the bottom part. I said that the story of Christ gathering people into community reaches one of its high points in the Last Supper. Perhaps I should have said low points. Here is Jesus, who has been pouring out his life for the people seated around the table. Now he has brought them together in the universal rite of friendship, family, hospitality, breaking bread together and passing the cup. And what do these people do? First, in response to Jesus' claim that one of them will betray him, they deny that any such thing is possible. Not us, Lord, not here, not in this nice church. Having taken care of that little matter, they move right along to an argument about who is the greatest among them. Blind to their own capacity for betrayal and obsessed with power struggles, the disciples at the table act out two of the issues that make community life so painfully difficult, so unlike the garden or the New Jerusalem. As someone has suggested, they probably went on to quibble over who would pay the bill. And what does Jesus do in the midst of all this? Being fully human, he must have been tempted to get up and leave, just as you and I are when our romantic images of community fail. But Jesus does not leave. Instead, he keeps breaking the bread and passing the cup. Both here and in the rest of the story, Jesus demonstrates his commitment to staying at the table. And so I want to use this image of the table, the Last Supper, but also your dining table at home, to paint a picture of what it might look like to live out the humanness of our spirituality now, in our day and time, in such a way that our faith might be not something obtuse or unattainable or disconnected to reality, but a living apologetic to the world that desperately needs a way forward toward hope. And I'm going to talk about this in three parts. I'm going to talk about coming to the table, or a sense of place, staying at the table, or a sense of presence, and leaving the table, or a sense of purpose. So I'm going to start with coming to the table. I want to start by showing you a few pictures from my house, specifically my dining room table. This picture was taken about a month ago when we were still on break between terms at LaBrie. As you can tell, there was not a lot of eating going on at this table. This is sadly sort of a common scene for me when the students leave, kind of chaos creeps in at the edges. But here's a picture next to it that I just took last week. The picture on the right is one that I took last Thursday, just a week ago. We've just started our fall term here, and welcomed the students back in, and I did the first dinner on the first night of term, and so I took this picture about 10 minutes before the students came up to my house for dinner. If I invited you to my house for dinner and you showed up and found the table looking like the picture on the left, you might start to wonder what was going on. You might wonder if you misheard or misunderstood the invitation, or if you were maybe meant to bring your own food, or maybe there's no dinner, we're just going to have coffee in the living room. The trappings of the table are not just for show, nor are they just functional. They are clear signs that a place has been prepared. The entire narrative of the Bible begins with an invitation or a call. Genesis chapter 1, verse 3. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. He called the earth and humans and all of creation into being. Jen Pollock Michelle says it like this. "Let there be light. God speaks and the world illuminates, birthing a prince and a planet. He blesses them. These are the words of divine desire, our great creator at his canvas. Every word is a brushstroke. He calls into being the world because he wants to. Desire is the good and beautiful momentum behind the artistry of Genesis 1. Let there be light. No compelling obligation stands behind these words. No shrugging sense of duty. Only the heartbeat of heaven and the desire of God for humanity." Most of our church services begin with a call to worship. This isn't just a way to corral everyone's attention at the beginning of the service, although it does do that too. But it serves as a tangible reminder that we are not there on our own steam. We are there because we were first called. An invitation was issued. In You Are What You Love, Jamie Smith reminds us that the call to worship in corporate church services echoes God's original call. He says, quote, "A reenactment of the primacy and sovereignty of the Creator in our lives. Just as we are called into being by the God who creates, so we are called into new life by that same God who redeems us in Christ by the power of His Spirit. Just as God's creative power made us to be human, so the Spirit's renewing power will enable us to be human." End quote. All of us are longing for a sense of place. It's a critical component for what it means to be human, and we're desperate for it. Our modern technologies give us the illusion that we can be in multiple places doing multiple things at once. Multitasking is the new gold standard of virtues, and many of us spend our weeks rushing from home to school to office to errands to soccer practice to shopping in our cars and on commuter trains, all while talking, negotiating, and planning on our phones. Where is our place, really? But from the beginning of the biblical narrative, we see that physical places and spaces were a very important part of the created order. Humans were made embodied. From the get-go, we were given a place, our own physical bodies. God didn't create human beings to float around the heavenlies like butterflies, or evaporate through walls like ghosts, or teleport from one place to another like superheroes. Although, I wish we did. That would be my superpower if I could choose one. It would be teleporting. Our souls, spirits, and minds cannot exist outside of our physical bodies. We cannot embrace God without also embracing our humanity, because it's in our embodied state that we come closest to imaging Him. In day-to-day life, the table provides a place to stop, touch down, and rest. Being at the table matters. Inviting someone to your table communicates a place has been set for you, both literally and figuratively. It's one of the most tangible ways that we echo the words of Jesus in John 14, "I am going there to prepare a place for you." But our humanity is often the thing that can keep us from coming to the table. At the beginning of our summer term, I was corresponding with a guy who was planning to come to LaBrie for a few weeks as a student. He was driving out from the Midwest and had decided to come about a week early to do some camping and hiking in New Hampshire before the start of term. And as I do with all incoming students, I asked him to let me know what time he would be arriving so that we could plan accordingly for meals. He told me he would be driving in late afternoon, and I wrote back and said that sounded great. We would plan to have him join us for dinner at 6 o'clock. But he wrote back and said, "Actually, don't worry about me for dinner. I'll probably get there right before 6. I'll be really dirty and smelly when I'm arrived. And I'll have some leftover food with me from my camping trip, so I'll just plan to pull into the parking lot and just eat in my car and wait until you're done with dinner." I was like, this is the reason we can't have you eating in your car while in the parking lot while we are in the house eating at the table. So he did get here in time to take a quick shower and join us for dinner. I don't think this was any great act of martyrdom or unworthiness on his part. I think he was really just trying to be considerate. He was anticipating that his arrival would be really tight with dinner, and he didn't want to subject the rest of us to the sights and smells of a week in the woods while we ate dinner. But it's something that has sort of stuck in my brain, because it served as a poignant image of how unworthy we often feel to accept the invitation and to come to the table, whether it's an invitation to the dinner table or to the table of the Lord. What keeps us away is often the trappings of our humanity. In some way, we are not enough. We're not smart enough, funny enough, attractive enough, or interesting enough to join that dinner party. We're not humble enough, holy enough, sorry enough, pure enough, or hopeful enough to accept God's invitation. But the table is the place that our not enoughs are actually the reason for the invitation in the first place. They are why we come to the table at all. So next section, staying at the table. Labrie, as some of you know, is not an easy place to describe. We had a whole lunch discussion about this last week. But the shorthand version is that it is a hospitality ministry. But the longer that I've stayed at Labrie, the more I've come to think of it as a ministry of presence. In the midst of all that we do at Labrie, I think the greatest gift we have to offer people is the gift of space. But space in the midst of community, not in isolation. Being present to one another, especially people who are other than we are, is becoming less and less common these days due to busyness and technology and work demands and a million other things. As Marty has pointed out in the past, hospitality is hard because no one is ever at home anymore. New York Times columnist David Brooks writes, "We have a tendency, especially in an achievement-oriented culture, to want to solve problems and repair brokenness, to propose, plan, fix, interpret, explain, and solve. But what seems to be needed is the art of presence." At Labrie, we like to make the distinction between entertaining, which is more like Martha Stewart dinner party, and hospitality, which is more along the lines of a family dinner. In his wonderful book, Reaching Out, Catholic theologian Henry Nouwen describes hospitality as offering an open and hospitable space where strangers can cast off their strangeness and become our fellow human beings. Another way he expresses it is as the creation of a free space where the stranger can enter and become a friend instead of an enemy. Hospitality is not to change people, but to offer them space where change can take place. This is certainly what Jesus has done for us and what we have the opportunity to both extend and receive from others. In her book, Living into Community, Christine Pohl says, "Hospitality is an invitation to mutual truthfulness." I love that quote. I'm sure we can all think of a time, or multiple times, when we were at a table, our own table, maybe in the homes we grew up in as children, or the homes we live in now, or at someone else, as a guest at someone else's table, where it felt like anything but a free and open space. Being at the table together can sometimes feel manipulative, stressful, hostile, heavy. I know someone who told me that as a young girl, she often went to play at the house of a friend of hers from church, and she loved her friend and loved her family. But sometimes the family would invite her to stay for dinner, and she hated it. She described their table as being really intense and stressful, where everyone, including guests at the table, were required to cite Bible verses for memory and to offer their opinions and then their defense of those opinions on a variety of subjects, most of which were chosen by the father in the house. And she said whenever they offered this invitation, she had kind of a deal with her mom where she would say, "Let me call my mom and check." And then her mom would say, "No, she has to come home. She can't stay for dinner." But I think we can all relate to that on some level. Being at the table is vulnerable. You sit close to people and you see their faces and you look into their eyes. Eating is one of the basest human activities there is, and we do it within spitting distance of each other, like literally, like sometimes people spit on us when they're eating. Staying at the table can be really hard sometimes for many reasons. Proximity, eye contact, bad breath, bad food, loud voices, awkward silences, dumb comments, controversial topics, spilled wine, broken glasses, harsh personalities, unspoken tension, embarrassment, you name it, and the potential is there. You can, all of us who have been at Labrie for a while have stories we could tell. And if you think about times when you were a child, there were probably times either with your siblings or with a friend at school or something where these words came out of your mouth. "I don't want to sit by him because..." fill in the blank. Or, "Don't make me sit by her." I said that a lot as a child about my sister. And as adults, we still think this. We just don't have the social space to say it out loud. And, I mean, do you ever feel nervous when you go to a wedding or to maybe a fundraising dinner or a special event where you know you won't have any control over where you sit? You're going to be placed at a table and placed with people at the table. I do. It's like they make whole romantic comedy movies out of these scenarios because there's such a potential for awkwardness. But at the table, we're forced to take our gaze off of ourselves. And part of what it means to be human is to live in relationship and communion with other people. God did not make us to live in individual bubbles. One of the big problems with community is that it is very often marked by idealism and disappointment. Very often, our hopes and expectations for relationships are based on how they will benefit us, how our needs can be met, how our gifts and talents can be offered in particular ways. We've been in term a week at Liberty, and we've already had a conversation about this passage I'm about to put up here. In his very famous work on Christian community, Life Together, Dietrich Bonhoeffer addresses this in chapter 1 of the book. Innumerable times, a whole Christian community has broken down because it has sprung from a wish dream. The serious Christian, set down for the first time in a Christian community, is likely to bring with him a very definite idea of what Christian life together should be and to try to realize it. But God's grace speedily shatters such dreams. Just as surely as God desires to lead us to a knowledge of genuine Christian fellowship, so surely must we be overwhelmed by a great disillusionment with others, with Christians in general, and if we are fortunate, with ourselves. And I have found that to be true personally. And we've seen that play out again and again and again here at Liberty. It's not until we've become disillusioned with others and with ourselves and that we can really start engaging at the level of what is actually real and actually true. And this is the place that Christ lived and continues to do his transformative work in and through us. It's not that our ideas and our ideals are unimportant or unspiritual. They're not. But they must be offered up to God and transformed by him through his redemptive work on the cross. Remember, Jesus did not come to make us Christian, but to make us more fully human. This should be a really freeing offer. Very often in our churches, taking communion can be a somber affair. And we're asked to take a hard look at our own hearts and lives and lay our sins before the Lord before we approach the table. But we do not do that because God requires perfect hearts in order for us to come. It's necessary because the broken places within us are what the table of the Lord is for in the first place. That's why he came, and that's why he invites us to come. At my church, we used to have one of the services. We used to have a time just before we took communion to greet each other with the peace of Christ. But we were also instructed to use that time to make amends, to truly make peace with anyone in the room that we had any kind of rift with. I always appreciated that as a reminder that none of us ever come to the table fully whole or holy. We come with our broken pieces and we lay them on the table. My colleague Sarah told me that her pastors often say that at the communion table, we not only remember what Christ has done for us, but we are literally remembered. Our scattered and broken pieces are brought back together and made whole through the broken body of Christ. This is the gospel. This is the family dinner we have all been invited to. And at the table of God, we are all the haves, not the have-nots. Jamie Smith says it this way. We are invited to sit down for supper with the creator of the universe, to dine with the king. But we are all invited to do so, which means we need to be reconciled to one another as well. Our communion with Christ spills over into communion as his body. There is a social, even political, reality enacted here. There are no box seats at this table, no reservations for VIPs, no filet mignon for those who can afford it, while the rest eat crumbs from their table. The Lord's table is a leveling reality in a world of increasing inequalities. The Lord's Supper isn't just a way to remember something that was accomplished in the past. It is a feast that nourishes our hearts. There is an existential meal that retrains our deepest, most human hungers. At the table of the Lord, our deep longings and hungers are not negated. They're transformed. We are not asked to separate ourselves from the things that make us human. We are asked to bring them with us to the table as an offering to the host that he might be the one to transform them and make them whole. Sharing meals together, whether in our churches or homes, is a reminder of the goodness of God's creation, the bounty of his provision, the sacredness of the table, and the beauty of community. All things that orient our lives toward the goodness of God's kingdom. Here is God's promise from Leviticus 26. I will look on you with favor and make you fruitful and increase your numbers, and I will keep my covenant with you. You will still be eating last year's harvest when you will have to move it out to make room for the new. I will put my dwelling place among you, and I will not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt so that you would no longer be slaves to the Egyptians. I broke the bars of your yoke and enabled you to walk with heads held high. God has made it possible that we would be able to walk with heads held high, the dignity and the worth inherent in our humanity restored through his love for us. His broken body makes our redeemed bodies possible. And with that, I want to kind of finally here say a few things about leaving the table. Or I wanted to call it mission, but one of the students said I had to have another P word. So purpose is what I came up with. But mission, purpose, you know that way. In Southborough, we have some Peruvian friends who are living in Boston for a few years. They're in school. And they come stay with us from time to time. One night, they were recounting some of the differences that they had noticed between Peruvian culture and American culture. One of the things that was striking to them was that in the U.S., when they were invited to people's homes for dinner, the tradition often seemed to be to get up from the table when the meal is over and move to a den or a living room to take coffee and dessert. They said that in Peru, you do not leave the table. And the idea is that something hard-earned has been gained by people at the table over the course of a meal, a greater knowing and intimacy and trust that's lost when you leave the table and reconfigure yourselves in another room, like a spell that's been broken. This has stuck with me because at the table, at both the dinner table and the Lord's table, something invaluable is gained. As Sarah's pastor said, we are remembered. We are put back together, both individually and corporately. We have seen and we have been seen. We have known and we have been known. So when we do leave the table, we step back out into our lives, into the world from a place of restored humanity, a place of strength, and a place of abundance, that abundance that the passage in Leviticus talked about. I remember a particular meal I had in college. I was doing a summer program with some other college students, and the host was someone who I did not know particularly well, but he had a beautiful home, and we had this amazing meal in his space. And there was something about the whole evening that just felt sort of magical and mystical to me. I don't know if you've ever had that kind of experience at a table. But I felt filled up from the inside out, not just my belly, but totally filled up. And I said as much to him on my way out the door as I was leaving, and he said, "This is a glimpse of heaven, Mary Frances. Get used to it, because we'll be gathered around a table together forever." At LaBrie, we often talk about the kingdom of God being both the now and the not yet. The kingdom is already at hand, as Christ is at work right now in the world. But the kingdom in all of its fullness is still yet to come. The poet T.S. Eliot said, "In my end is my beginning." And that is true for us as well. Where we think we are going, the end that we think we are moving toward, determines what we do now. As Christians, we believe that we are moving toward the fulfillment of God's kingdom. But what does that look like? Over the break, back in August, I was in Tennessee visiting my family. And my parents and I went to a Lyle Lovett concert. I don't know if anybody knows Lyle Lovett. If you don't, he's awesome. I love him. And he has this fantastic band, his big band. And one of the songs that they played was the old spiritual song, I'll Fly Away. I love that song. Many of you have known it, may know it. Alison Krauss and Gillian Welch recorded it somewhat recently, so it's kind of had a resurgence. I'm not going to sing it for you, but I just want to read. The chorus says, I'll fly away, oh glory, I'll fly away. When I die, hallelujah, by and by, I'll fly away. And one of the verses says, when the shadows of this life have gone, I'll fly away. Like a bird from prison bars has flown, I'll fly away. I was sitting there listening and singing along because I love that song. And because my head was sort of here, I started preparing for this lecture, I was like, that's not true. This image of leaving our bodies and flying away to heaven is everywhere. We see it portrayed in films and television, kind of a death scene where you see someone's maybe body on the ground and then you see sort of their spirit kind of float up. It's in hymns, it's in gospel music. But the picture that the Bible gives of the kingdom of God coming down is actually not one of disembodied souls flying around the heavenlies, but embodied people from every tribe and tongue and nation coming together for what? A wedding banquet. We will be seated at the table for the wedding feast of the Lamb. This is the end that humans are moving toward. Jamie Smith writes, to be human is to be on a quest. To live is to be embarked on a kind of unconscious journey toward a destination of your dreams. As Blaise Pascal put it in his famous wager, you have to wager. It's not up to you. You are already committed. You can't not bet your life on something. You can't not be headed somewhere. We live leaning forward, bent on arriving at the place we long for. Theologian Eugene Peterson wrote that a spiritual theology is a lived theology. The communion table and the dinner table is the place we live this out in vivid technicolor. The God of the Bible is a hospitable God, the one who first welcomed us in when we were strangers, and the one who welcomed us to his table to restore the fullness of our good, God-given humanity. Not only so that we could be restored to a right relationship with him, but also to one another and to ourselves and to the created world. The hospitality of God at the Lord's Supper is a sign of his grace and generosity that we are to imitate. This is a primary way that we image him. The popular, familiar question, what would Jesus do? People ask. And the gospel tells us, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. Jesus gathered those around him, and he ate with them. And the ones he gathered were not on anyone's VIP list for a dinner party. They were confused, power-hungry, distracted, greedy. They were betrayers, fighters, and doubters. And that was just the 12 disciples. The strife that was present at the Last Supper is still present with us today. These are difficult times for many people. It's been a hard week in America. Our country right now is split on so many issues. But issues do not only exist in the theoretical or on our Facebook page or our blog post, but they come down and they land in physical space and time. We look around us and see stripes of every shape and color. We are divided. We are divided people down gender lines, political lines, racial lines, economic lines, employment lines. The struggle for airtime and power and survival are real. To wrap up here, I just want to ask you, give you this question to think about. Who are the strangers in your life? Who could use a seat at your literal or figurative table? Not because you have something to offer them, but because in their otherness, they just might have something to offer you. If you think in your mind of a particular person or a type of person that you would least want to be seated at the table with, go back to your childhood of like, don't make me sit by her. that's probably the best place to start. And I want to close with this awesome quote here. Because we are all made in God's image, His worth and dignity is bestowed upon us long before we did anything efficient or productive or meaningful. We are made to do this again through Jesus Christ, and we eat and drink. We do this together to remember the redeeming work He has done for all of us. One of my pastors says that the most human thing we can do is to bear the image of Christ as God, side by side, in community, and declare His intention for personal relationships. Sorry, I jumped ahead to that too quickly. As Christ welcomed us when we were strangers, so do we image Him as we welcome those who are strangers in our midst. He is the ultimate host, and by His mercy, His Spirit does a transformative work as we seek to be changed more and more into His likeness. Our hope is not in our good works, but that God is building heaven on earth through our human brokenness, not separate from it, as we break bread together. This quote is from a fantastic book called The Supper of the Lamb by Robert Farrar Capon. He passed away a few years ago, but he was an Episcopal priest and a cook. And it's a wonderful book on food and theology. If you haven't read it, I would highly recommend it. And he says this: "Nothing is more likely to become garbage than orange rind. But for as long as anyone looks at it in delight, it stands a million triumphant miles from the trash heap. That, you know, is why the world exists at all. It remains outside the cosmic garbage can of nothingness, not because it is such a solemn necessity that nobody can get rid of it, but because it is the orange peel hung on God's chandelier, the wishbone in His kitchen closet. He likes it, therefore it stays. The whole marvelous collection of stones, skins, feathers, and string exists because at least one lover has never quite taken his eye off it, because the Dominus Vivificans has His delight with the sons of men." And I would just say that you are the orange rind. As Schaeffer would say, a glorious ruin. But you are the orange rind on God's chandelier. And He takes great delight in that. And I'm going to stop there. And for those of you who are new to LaBrie, never been here before, we, after our Friday night lectures, just like to spend some time in discussion. If anybody has a question, please ask it, or a comment. If you are welcome to disagree, if you have a problem with something that I said, and we'll keep going either until we run out of questions or I get tired and then I'll cut it off. So anyway, anybody can open it up.
Well, Mary Frances, thank you for introducing us to this very interesting topic, which runs through the whole of the experience here at LaBrie. I recently heard a podcast from a woman named Dr. Edith Humphreys from the Pittsburgh Seminary, and she had an interesting reflection on how Jesus fed the 5,000, and that was another episode of Him serving a dinner, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And He took them into a green field, which is so evocative of the picture of Psalm 23, of lying down in green pastures and being cared for by the Good Shepherd. But also he almost could be said to be recreating Israel in that doing, that He assigned the 12 apostles to be the servants who would bring food to all of the people gathered around. Mm-hmm. The 5,000 men plus their women and children. Mm-hmm. And the apostles enacted the roles of servant leaders who were bringing food around. And it was like recreating the whole nation of Israel. Mm-hmm. And showing people what the kingdom of heaven is like for just a few hours. Mm-hmm. So that's another instance of the table, which wasn't quite a table, but...
Yep.
But it was a scene. And,
yeah.
Of course, he collected 12 baskets of leftovers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think, there's images of that all through Scripture. And I should have said this at the beginning. I recognize not everybody has a dining room table in their home. Coffee tables count, and sitting in a circle on the floor counts, and picnic tables count, and yeah, but this idea of this shared experience of a meal together is really quite significant. One thing that I didn't bring up that that is becoming kind of more and more of an issue or just impacts this is our ability to eat together is just the way that our sort of attitudes and posture towards food is different. It's becoming very individualized. That actually it's getting harder and harder to feed people. there's a rise in food allergies, which are, you know, very legitimate things, that there's certain foods that make certain people ill. But I think we're seeing sort of patterns of eating and diets and things like that that people are sort of choosing for themselves to sort of, whatever, magnify their health or their, you know, there's all kinds of reasons for things that makes this kind of shared experience of eating together, a shared meal, more and more challenging. Yeah. So, thank you. Other things?
I wanted to thank you. It was really, really beautiful for the way you put all of the thoughts together. And I was listening to it, and when I first read the title, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I didn't either when I picked it up. You knew that.
And I was trying to figure out the different words in your title, and I was like, I don't know. But it's amazing because when I was growing up, my parents intentionally did this in our family, and I have so many beautiful memories of our family sitting down and having dinner with no distraction, and we would light candles just like on an average weekday, and purposely take all of the schoolwork, we were homeschooling, take all the schoolwork off the table and make it supper, and sit and talk and laugh, and I just remember feeling that special protective feeling of being with a family. And a lot of times I could feel the presence of God there because it was like we were setting apart that time to be together. And one of my favorite memories of having that dedicated time is Christmas morning. We come down for breakfast and we purposely create a spot for Jesus at the table, and we sing to him, and then we eat with him, and it's amazing, you can totally feel it. We give him birthday presents of ourselves and things we want to work on in the year. It's just beautiful. So I was really appreciating the way you were talking about it, and I think, like you were saying, the culture, it's so hard to reenact that feeling. But I've noticed that whenever our family has done this multiple times, we just make an open invitation to our church family of whoever wants to come over can come over. And so many times, not very many people have come, but they're always like, that is so generous and hospitable, and how do you cook on a food for it? Well, it's God's gift, and we have to serve what he's given us, so come over. So, it's incredible. I feel really blessed and really enjoyed it.
Thank you. You are blessed in that, having that experience. I had a similar experience of growing up in a family that ate dinner together most nights, and that that's changing. I think just as for very practical reasons. I mean, most of my childhood, my mom was home with us or worked part time, but so many families now, both parents are working. They're working full time. The economic pressures of life now has changed. We live in a restaurant culture where it's so easy to just go grab food or pick up food, and so eating at home just happens less and less and less. And it's interesting. It's something that I just took for granted. And then since being at LaBrie and sharing a table with so many different and new people, it's been interesting to see. We have people who come to LaBrie for whom being at the table is very uncomfortable. We all eat together three times a day, give or take a couple meals during the week where we do something different. But for some people, it's a very hard thing, and they're, you know, they don't push their chair up all the way to the table. They're jittery. They're fidgeting with the candles. They're, you know, if they feel self-conscious eating in front of other people. I mean, it's something that we're definitely, as a culture, losing. We're sort of losing. I've read a couple articles. Nikayla, I don't know if you know any of this stuff, but I don't have any of it with me, but I've just seen some things that one of the things that they're finding that they recommend for people with especially young children and pre-adolescent and adolescent children, they've actually done studies that pre-adolescents and teenagers who regularly sit down and share meals with their family, there's like a lower risk factors for everything. I mean, for everything. Teenage pregnancy, eating disorders, higher self-esteem. I don't know if you know any of that.
80%.
Yeah. It's quite drop. Yeah. It's one of those things where you think like, oh, it's actually sort of connected to public health issues, you know, and it's not just a matter of eating healthier food. I mean, it really is this idea of sitting down and eating at a table with a family, which is really interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hearing Irma mention what they mentioned before about eating at a table and the spirituality and the humanness being redundant, it made me think of friends who I know who are Jewish or became Jewish, and how Shabbos begins the meal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm thinking of how you're describing the feeling you get when you set aside time to eat together, and you were saying how it's kind of like magical, and it's over at the end, but how magical.
Yeah.
When you think about Sabbath, like real Sabbath rest.
Yeah.
Nothing concrete, because I thought of Sabbath, I thought of my friends, and how the ones who are more traditional, they try to get the whole meal done before sundown, mm-hmm. and that's how it starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think, there's multiple reasons for this. I think kind of people in the Jewish faith kind of do a better job of this in some ways. I mean, food is such a part of the rite and the ritual and the culture. It's a really awesome thing. Were we talking about this at one of my meal tales this week? We were talking about something different. But Judaism, in some ways Catholicism, more even liturgical branches of the Protestant Church tend to have a more kind of embodied theology than most Protestant churches do now. You know, just the idea of kneeling to take communion, of bowing before you walk into a pew, of eating together, of sharing those things is I think there's sort of other groups of people that sort of have that, I think kind of have their hand on that in a better way than kind of most run-of-the-mill Protestant churches do. But, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I resonate very positively with almost everything you said.
But?
There's some, I think in modern life, the meal is going to leave something out. I grew up on a farm, and we had great family meals with delightful discussions, with running to the encyclopedia to check things out, we were considered crazy, but it wasn't arguing or competing. It was we learned something, and someone shared something, and run the encyclopedia. But we were tired. But we all learned something.
Okay.
So it was a joyous time, and it was a time of we worked hard and we ate heartily, so we felt our bodies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then I got a desk job, and on the farm the meal was celebratory every day because you felt, wow, we accomplished a lot. Mm-hmm. Here's the reward. Mm-hmm. Then I got a desk job, a lot of anxiety, things didn't get done. And I would go to my new place, eat with other people, eat a meal, and I needed something to relieve the anxiety. So, you know, I ate more, started gaining weight.
Mm-hmm.
I felt less human because I've been so inactive.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to suggest that in the biblical times, they were very active, fishermen, mm-hmm. everything else, so the meal was part of being human.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to suggest that simply substituting, simply paying attention to the meal in modern life, mm-hmm. misses a part of feeling very alive. Mm-hmm. I know what it means for a meal to make you feel less alive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. I think I would disagree with you a little bit on that, in that I don't think it's the meal's fault. You know, I think what you're tapping into something really significant, which is our lifestyles are totally different than they used to be. In some ways, we're less connected. Our work, for many people, not for everyone, but for many people, our work disconnects us from our bodies. And I think that what you're describing of, you know, I need a release from the anxiety and so I eat more and whatever. I think, again, I don't think that's...
It's not the meal's fault, but the meal can't... The meal alone can't fix the problem.
Oh, of course not.
And so, so it's like not having a complete diet. Protein is this great thing, but if that's all you get,
right.
you're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to imply here that food or the process of eating a meal is our salvation. Jesus is our salvation. You know, so food itself, but I think what you're talking about, I think there is very much a way that we can see food and consume food in a very disembodied way. And I think that's what you're describing, and I think that's
a
huge issue.
When you live a disembodied life, it's hard to...
Mm-hmm. And food sort of becomes, I mean, I think this is one of the things I'm talking about for people who, you know, food has become this thing that instead of, you know, in generations past where people did physical work all day on a farm, you ate what was there, you ate what was in season, you ate what your neighbors brought to you. It's like we don't even get out of our car. We don't even stop moving. And we stop moving to, like, pay and get the bag out of the drive-thru window, right? And then we eat it in the car. I mean, it's a totally disembodied approach to food.
Sorry. Okay.
Well, I have another question later.
Okay, Marty.
This relates. I mean, growing up on a farm, you're actually connected to how food grows and it's real food. I like Michael Pollan's description.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine what Americans eat today isn't food. Mm-hmm. And he says, don't eat anything that your grandmother wouldn't have recognized as food. So, there's something real there. I remember, you're eating vegetables that you grew. You have some, it's healthy.
Yeah,
or meat or cow, milk that comes from your cows. And the disconnection from, and then just like grocery stores are full of things that aren't food anymore, which has a lot to do with why there's so much of an obesity problem and addictions to sugar and so on. So it's what you eat also. And being at the table together, but also what you eat. And I think it's really helpful for people to get connected to where the food comes from. Mm-hmm. Remember when we lived in England, working with English degree, there was some, you know, English butcher shop. You see the animal hanging, and you don't get frozen in little patties. But we had American students who just completely freaked out by seeing
the animal.
Animals hanging in the butcher shop window. Yeah. Oh, I would never eat that. Well, you do eat that, actually. We eat that every time you buy a frozen hamburger patty. That's where it comes from. Anyway, there's something very disconnected.
Yeah, and even in ways, I mean, I went to the grocery store today and I wanted raspberries and I was annoyed because I didn't have any and I had to buy strawberries instead. Like, you shouldn't be able to buy raspberries in Massachusetts on September 23rd. I mean, you shouldn't, like, or strawberries, you know, but we can, I can, you know. Danny?
I think it's just kind of the things that we're saying about the way that we're removed so much from our food, from, like, our removal from that, our separation from that, just show that the amount of intentionality is quite incredible. At the rate, it's wonderful to come here to be able to sit. There's so much intention, so much dedication to it that I think, you know, like when I went back over break, I had these, you know, very well intended, ideas that I can't go over, but the intention is that. Mm. Or to really connect to food, or to really understand what the meal could be, and really make that connection.
It does.
I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, I just as an example, I'm having some friends over for dinner tomorrow night. Tomorrow's my day off. I'm having some friends over for dinner. I invited them a month ago, and I'm tired. I've been working on this lecture. I've already prepared several big meals this week for the students. My house is a wreck. Like, you know, there's a sense where I have all day tomorrow. I have time to do it, and it'll be great, and I'll be glad when they're coming. But there's part of me where I'm like, that's not what I want to do tomorrow. You know, to clean up and clear the table now looks like what it looks like in that first picture. Clear the table again and cook the food. Yeah, I mean, and this is what I do for work. I don't have another job that, you know, it is. It takes a lot of intention and time and energy. Yeah.
Also, too, sort of from what people have been saying, I was thinking the other day about, like, so I reread this piece of quote about how he said our desires today, God's sincere desires is too strong but too weak. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't desire the good things that he could give us.
Yeah.
And, like, even with a simple thing like food, like everyone has been saying, we don't eat real food anymore. We don't desire a meal that's intentionally been created to be pleasing or artistic or flavorful. And I especially remember noticing, so we went to France last spring, and, like, I was like, this food is amazing. Because we were, you know, it was an average hotel to them, but, like, it was fresh cheese and fresh bread and fresh stuff. I was like, this tastes so good.
Yeah.
I didn't think I liked cheese, but this is amazing. Yeah. And, like, so I was thinking about it, I was like, you know, when we are creating food for people, or when we're creating anything for anyone, if you have, like you said, if you have an intentionality in it, then it makes it that much more of a gift instead of just putting together frozen hamburger and supper with me.
Yeah. But it also doesn't have to be fancy. I mean, there is this piece where the food is significant, but part of this piece is we're around the table, you know, and even if what that means is like you've tossed together a salad and you've ordered a pizza, but if you're sitting at the table and you're eating together, you know, there's something in that too. Yeah.
I really loved your lecture. I thought
thank
it was
you.
Fantastic. So thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question, I don't want it to come out as negative because I really loved the lecture, but I'm just curious as to how you, because I know you put a lot on Plato. Going back to the beginning point about the separation between body and spirit. But I think that we have to be honest and look, like you did mention Paul, that the New Testament does seem to point out this body and spirit divide and distinction. Just read a few verses from Romans 7. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am flesh, sold into bondage to sin. And let's see. Verse 18. I know that nothing good dwells in me that is in my flesh. For the willing is present in me, but the doing of the good is not. Let's see. 23. But I see a different law in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind, and making me a prisoner of the law of sin, which is in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will set me free from the body of this death. So, how do you reinterpret that without doing butchery to the text and still keep the beauty that you brought forward tonight?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's holding together. I mean, I mentioned this briefly, but this idea of there is a self that we are called to die to and to give up. You know, our sin, our selfishness, these things in us that are not of God and that are really, you know, again, you kind of go back to the beginning of Genesis and that. You know, Adam and Eve eating from the tree and what's inherent in that is really wanting to be God, right? Wanting to be like God, wanting to have the power, wanting to have the knowledge, wanting to have the control. And I think, you know, Paul speaks a lot of those things. And I think dying to self and dying to those fleshly desires in the sense of wanting really to usurp God in some ways. But I think what's happened is that we tend to, it's funny, I'm thinking of one particular student who I talked with some this summer, but we see this in so many people that then it becomes a sort of like, then everything about me is bad. My imagination is bad. Every desire I have is bad. Everything is sinful. There's nothing good in me. And I think there's this, I think it's helpful to think about sin as being something that's pervasive and that it touches every part of our life, but it doesn't, what's the word? It doesn't sort of, it touches every part, but it doesn't sort of consume every single part. So there's no part that's free from that. But yeah.
That's interesting. I just was wrestling with exactly that text recently, and reading through John Scott's commentary on women in that passage. And it's even more clear in a passage in Colossians that it's really tricky the way Paul uses the word flesh. Because the flesh is in that passage, and also very clearly in Colossians, is the principle of sin. It doesn't mean this stuff on my bones. It's read the Colossians passage, because the sins of the flesh and of pride.
The argument with Paul was also with me.
Yeah.
The body and there's more. The Bible study was to deal with your question. We need to have more of a Bible study than we have time for in this session. But basically, there's a real distinction between flesh, which is used to represent the indwelling power of sin in your whole being, and flesh, which is what you've got in your bones, which is your body. Paul isn't always clear what's exactly which he's using, but the wider context is. One of the places that's most interesting to me is in Colossians 2, where he's arguing against everybody who's wanting to make lots of rules about insisting on self-abasement, worship of angels, dwelling on visions, and say, puffed up without cause by human way of thinking, not holding fast.
So people can hear you that way.
But yeah, I'm just trying to.
But Mary's not just talking about the body. She's talking about dreams and desires.
Yeah.
It's not just the body.
I'm sorry. I started reading too early here, because he's dealing with a lot of different things. But he's talking about restrictions on the body. Why do you submit to all these regulations that are restricting your body? Like, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. All these regulations refer to things that perish with use. They are simply human commands and teachings. They have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-imposed piety, humility, and severe treatment of the body, but they have no value in checking the indulgence of the flesh.
Mm, that's good.
Now that to me is a really interesting way of really separating them, right? Which he doesn't as clearly as that a lot of places. But this is, I mean, what you're raising would be a very careful Bible study for Romans 7. Actually,
I think I have something that makes, I mean, this is also something I thought about when you were teaching, which I feel similarly. I don't want to come across as negative, but there's something that, has anyone heard of the book called The Religions of Man by Huston or Houston Smith?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was written in the 1960s or so. Written in the 1960s, and what it was a book. Instead of looking at the theology of the major religions of the earth, he looked at how the average practitioner of each religion held it, what they got out of Hinduism, what the average practitioner gets out of each thing. And he said something very interesting about Judaism. He said, he went to Genesis and said, look at that. Judaism has, let me back up. Most religions with the exception of Taoism, but almost every major religion says that we are spiritual in spite of our physical body. Mm-hmm. Whereas Judaism made it clear that the physical body grew out of a spiritual, mm-hmm. and it was very good. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's my answer, mm-hmm. my addition to your statement about sin touching or mm-hmm. being, you know. So I would say, I mean, Houston Smith had hoped that Christianity would extend to the same thing, but obviously mm-hmm. I would say Christianity has been contaminated by the idea that we're spiritual in spite of our bodies, mm-hmm. which is anti-Judaism thought. And he went on to say that in the Jewish tradition, they would almost never abstain from marriage. Very few mm-hmm. sects would do that. Because everything made by good God, well, I'm putting the statement now, but everything made by God is good and to be enjoyed. So I found this intriguing. He said in Taoism, the human body was good, but the human body was just in the middle of the ecology. It was not the top. So Judaism, he really identified this as a real distinction between Judaism and supposedly Christianity. And that's part of the answer. Yeah. The other question I would have is that I saw in a book, I wish I'd bought the book, but anyway, it said that Christian philosophers, starting in the time of Constantine, being influenced by the Greeks, asked very different questions than they did before Constantine. I've always wondered what the, after Constantine, they started asking the Platonic questions. Mm-hmm. Before Constantine, there was far more Hebraic influence. I'm just curious if anybody knows mm-hmm. what the questions were, mm-hmm. what the mindset of believers was before Greek came in.
I think it's a hard sell. There's a lot of Greek thought they were dealing with the educated people who were educated in Greek philosophy.
So that might have been a wrong statement in the book.
I'm just thinking because you've had your hand up for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just give all glory to our Father, mm-hmm. and I share because of Him, and I'm really thankful for this. It speaks to me in a lot of different ways that I won't go into. But I'm really thankful, and I love this space. Like, this is my first time here. I just love to run my mouth and listen to people talk.
You're in the right place.
Yeah,
that's what we do. We run our mouth.
And everybody's really smart, and that's nice. But I really appreciate, I want to just share something really quick that really doesn't have anything to do with my testimony. Well, some has to do with my testimony, but don't forget, like, the sin that is within us, but, like, corporate sin as well. Mm-hmm. So, like, this really connects into the history. And, like, mm-hmm. the people in the Bible are our ancestors, and, like, all of that. So, like, all of that up until now. And just have that be in mind. But my testimony from this week really speaks from just the place. It's like, giving people a place, creating a place mm-hmm. and giving people a place. And so I've really been challenged. Christ has been challenging me around being in a relationship. So as a black woman, I feel like doing urban ministry and being in the city, I feel like, oh, I really can connect, whatever, but that's not true because we all have very individual lives and individual experiences, and just because we may look alike or live in the same place or whatever doesn't mean that we really connect. And so He's been challenging me and convicting me, which I thank Him for. And I ran into this person who has struggled with homelessness and, struggled with addiction and mental illness, and just really, I've lived with him, and he's, like, stolen before, and, like, he lies a lot, and he does all this stuff or whatever, and I feel, I have, like, this power dynamic where I feel like, oh, okay, well, every time I see him or with him, that I need to help him, And so then, but through that convention this week, I ran into him, and we spent 3 hours together just kind of talking, and this is how I engage with a lot of people that I do ministry to or whatever, I give to you, I give to you, I give to you or whatever. And but I was like very present with him for 3 hours and like praying to God the whole time. And he said something that just blew my mind, which was very true. And it helped him to see himself and feel himself, and that was like, you know, a victory. But he said, you know, Sierra, we're very similar. We're in the same place actually, and that really humbled me, and I was thankful for that. And we shared a meal. Now, mostly when I share a meal, people I do ministry with, I buy the meal, and I'm like, oh, I need to feed you, whatever. I do a little bit of like food. I work in a little bit of the food sector, whatever. So I'm always like, oh, I have food, so let me give. And in that very moment, like in the space, I was just so present. Like, a guy was just so, the Holy Spirit was just so present. Mm-hmm. He like offered. He was like, this is someone who's like poor. He's poor. You know, he's like, oh, you want something to drink? You know, like, and it just blew me. Like, no one offers, you know, offers that. And so, like, this is that right there. Like, that's that meal. Like, not a meal. Like, it's beautiful. Like, to sit at his table. We were like at Target, and he bought us like a pizza and vitamin water.
Yeah.
And like that was it. That was it. Like, that was like legit. Like, that was it. And so like it blew my mind, and it really, like, the angels were singing praises, and I mean, we laughed, but that was real. And
So we have a picture of that in the Bible too, right? Of the woman who, this idea of just giving all you have, and if all you have is, if you're giving all you have, even if it's very small, it's a greater gift. This idea of kind of giving sacrificially than someone who can just have a lot to give. And you saw that lived out.
Another same sort of thing happened to me. I was with a friend, and we were in a very urban city. I live in a city, but it's a lot smaller, so I was not feeling very comfortable. And so my friend was looking for this other guy who was his friend, but in a very ministry way. So this other man was just like on the street and not in a good spot. And so I was feeling very nervous. I didn't want to meet this person. I didn't want to hear his story. I did not like want to see what he was doing. But I was like, God, I have to do this, because if I don't do this, then I'm obviously disobeying you. So we found this guy, and I remember like having, almost unconsciously, having this very strict prejudice against him. And like, before I saw him, I was like, oh, he's going to be dirty, he's going to look like this, blah, 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 he's going to be, you know. And when I saw him, I was like, oh, he's just like a guy. Like, it just hit me, like, he's not scary because he's hurting. So, it really, like, struck me, and I felt terrible that I had been judging this person I had never met. And we took him to evening service, and the church provides water like you do UT. And so the homeless guy, he went over and got himself a drink of water, and then he poured one for me and handed it to me. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it wasn't, he didn't buy it or whatever, but he served me. And I was just like, I don't know if I can take this right now because I'm going to cry because this is amazing. And I feel so horrible. But God was like, it's okay, you know, you did your part by at least obeying me, even though you didn't do it willingly. And then after that, the service was beautiful and, like, touched me in an amazing way. And then I just heard that this man now is enrolled in their, like, sort of redemption program, and he's getting back on his feet and helping him. I was just like, this is amazing, God. You showed me this man's redemption one afternoon and fixed my heart at the same time. So, similar story.
Yeah, and I mean, you both bring up an interesting dynamic that comes into play, is that there very often is this, for lack of a better word, a power dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, in certain situations it does seem like one person is the have and one person is the have not. And so we kind of can easily fall into these roles and expectations around people. And I think being able to extend hospitality and offer grace to people is a really important thing, but being able to receive it for some of us is more challenging. It's a much more challenging place to be. It's a more humbling place to be, and it really forces us to sort of, it puts right in our face our ideals and stereotypes and prejudices that we have about people, our ideas about ourselves and how, what we think we have to offer and what we think we have to give. And so being on the receiving side, is just as significant. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Richard, yes.
Okay, let me throw another wrench into this discussion. Well, I didn't really throw a wrench before, but let me throw one now. Okay, so obviously eating, fellowship around the table, hospitality, these are all very important things in our spiritual life. There is a balance to be made apparently with another thing, which is something that most of us sort of hate, the thing called fasting.
Come back in a couple weeks. Josh was lecturing on that.
Okay, number 14. All right, so we're at the other side of that. All right, so.
Yeah.
So is there, you know, an obvious counterpoint here? Is the purpose of the fasting in part so that we appreciate the food more? Is that part of what's going on? You have any thoughts?
Take it away, Dr. Chestnut.
I think people fast obviously for very different reasons. And I think fasting primarily in the Bible is a responsive activity as opposed to instrumental. So we see people not necessarily fasting to get something out of fasting. So it's not as much I want X or Y or Z, so I'm going to fast and pray and hope to get it. It's more as though certain things happen, and then in response to that, people fast. I mean, things do taste better after you fast. That's a true thing. And, you know, people fast for health reasons. I don't know. Did that answer that? Or...
That was a good start, isn't
it? Come back, there's church.
We don't want to give it all away before.
Okay. Tune in again to the next episode.
Nikki.
This is just more a comment of the idea of a failure to thrive. And that term is for newborn, but I think it's also. We see that in each other, and in failing to thrive is that isolation more than anything. Mm-hmm. And when we eat in isolation, when we all of those things that we become really hard and we don't become vulnerable, all these things, like the idea of I think Christine's idea of movement toward mutual truthfulness doesn't happen at the table. So it's not just the eating, it's the invitation of thriving. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that we hear at the table. Mm-hmm. Is people are starting to thrive, or people mm-hmm. are coming alive. Mm-hmm. And there is that sense of recovering your humanity over and over at the table. And it's not just about the food and, you know, going home from work and eating, and that's all. Mm-hmm. Like Tom, in out of our anxiety, we're eating. But we are moving towards mutual truthfulness. And I think that does happen at the table, and that does happen when you're not isolated. And I think that's why they're seeing that families that eat together, their children do thrive, and mm-hmm. they're less of a risk factor. And mm-hmm. last term, we had an addiction psychiatrist here from Stanford, and he said, you know what, in 50 years, I think that the treatment for any addict will be to eat with a family. And I just think that's what the treatment will look like. Mm-hmm. Inviting somebody into your home, and not by a religious,
right,
you know, thing at all, but because of what happens when you take somebody out of isolation and invite them into the home. Mm-hmm. He said, and that's just the gospel,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Offering people a place to thrive.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And that ties in. I loved the thing that Sarah told me about her pastors talking about being remembered, kind of this idea of being put back together. And I think what we see a lot at Libri, and I mean, I experienced this in my life, I'm sure a lot of you guys do too, is that we just live very fragmented lives. And what we see, I mean, we're not necessarily trying to do this for people when they come to Libri, but people come to Libri and we see sort of an integration happening. We hope that that happens. We pray that that happens. But this idea of being less kind of fractured and more integrated. And I think, Nikki, what you're talking about, that really comes into play, because I think the isolation, we lose perspective. Like, we can't see. And one of the powerful, really powerful roles of relationship in community is that it acts like a mirror for us to be able to see ourselves in a more holistic and realistic way, and to sort of shift and move where we need to. David?
Yeah, we've experienced this lack of community in recent months at the Van Bay House, where we're resident directors. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time to build community, as you all know, but it doesn't take very long for it to break down. And so what has happened with the six international students and ourselves is that there was a great sense of community, because we did have Sunday night dinners together, mm-hmm. where we invited six or seven other people to mm-hmm. join us. And so there was a great decor and community. But what has happened is that the Van Bay House has been under reconstruction for 3.5 months. And so we have not had a regular time of Sunday night dinners collectively, where we can invite others in to help form and keep our community solidified. Mm-hmm. And so what we have seen is that it has started to break down in that 3.5 months, and is evidenced by the need for peacemaking. Because there's relationships between residents in the house and ourselves that have broken down because we did not have this regular vehicle and time for coming together to talk about substantive issues.
Yeah.
Fortunately, that's coming to a conclusion in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But what you said, it really resonated, and it was a personal experience in the last few months.
Yeah. Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Right.
Coming off what you said, when I came to Libri this summer, I was a teacher, so summer you have a lot of time off. But I don't think this is something that a lot of people experience in modern day life. You can be, alone in the city, even with roommates, and not having a great time, and then be invited to different activities, and you pull it together, you get dressed, and you go out, and you say, hey, like, oh my gosh, it's so funny, did you watch the show? And you might be at a restaurant, you might be at the dinner table, but there's that sense that you mentioned in your lectures, where at the table, the student came, didn't want to come in to disrupt dinner, and when I came to Libri, which now is coming to my mind, one of the many blessings that I feel like I received was you're in this space where you come to every meal. Mm-hmm. So no matter where you are, you're asking questions or emotionally or whatever you're doing, you come to every meal and you share it. And it's okay if you're not bubbly or if you're not wearing enough clothes. You could have just been really sweaty outside, and you still come to dinner. So,
Yeah. Come as you are. Much more than I think we do in other places. Yeah. Marty?
I was just thinking how just the role of social history here, and I've lectured at conferences a lot on hospitality, and I often get, over and over again, pastors who are trying to encourage this kind of thing in churches say, the problem is, nobody's home and everybody's so busy.
Mm-hmm.
And things not that long ago, well, maybe 150 years ago, maybe that's a long time ago, when work took place in the home, and when basically the economy was based in and from the home, and basically everything was based in and from the home. For example, sick people used to be sent to live with their doctor. Mm. People who were breaking the law were sent to live with a family and work on their farm. And it just, the kind of thing you're talking about happened, and that Tom talked about, happened just naturally.
Right. It
could not happen. You know, you were living, working together, and eating three meals together. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge. This isn't just basically just to say we're dealing with this incredible challenge and the need to be really be intentional and think of different ways of doing things. Thinking of maybe, you know, intentionally cooking more food, having more food on hand so that you can invite somebody back from church on Sunday, somebody who's not, you know, who doesn't know anybody who is visiting or whatever, or just somebody you don't particularly know.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, hospitality, which in Greek word, cyberlinia, actually means loving the stranger. It doesn't mean entertaining. And people tend to feel much more comfortable if their home isn't perfect. Mm-hmm. And if you invite them in and say, here's some carrots and a board, can you chop them up? I mean, you get people actually helping rather than having inviting people for dinner, because this huge entertainment. I can't have anybody until my house is perfect. I can't have anybody until I get this Martha Stewart recipe down. You know? So it's just a comment to say that where we are in social history, how things have changed since work left the home, since so many people are not in their homes anymore and are racing home and are exhausted, and it's much easier just to grab something.
Yeah.
So it needs really being intentional and thinking ahead to make it happen.
Yeah, and kind of like, Danny, you moved. What Danny said earlier about being here this summer and then going home and having all these grand plans to do meals and realizing how hard it was, and you have to be so intentional. One of the things in thinking about sort of disillusionment with community, one of the things that I hear a lot from people who leave LaBrie is they leave LaBrie and then they want to do something similar at home, or they've sort of tasted something here of community and life around the table and life together that they want to build into their life, and it doesn't happen. And I think for people who come stay at LaBrie, there can sometimes be a sense that it's like what happens here is all very organic. And LaBrie did have a somewhat organic start back in the day, but we're not organic. I mean, they're like, Michaela spends hours at the beginning of term creating a 3-month schedule of who is cooking what meal every day. It's not like, you know, I'm not like, hey guys, I'm in the mood to cook today, I'll just do lunch today. That's not how we do it. It's very intentional, and so we know, and we, you know, I know when my meals are, and so I shop for them, and I plan, and I have a head count, and I, you know, so it's very intentional here too. It just doesn't seem that way sometimes, but yeah, and I think it's interesting. One of the things that I've tried to do recently, this is what I'm doing tomorrow. I don't really make New Year's resolutions, but I'm sort of in the opposite camp because I have strangers in my home all the time. My New Year's resolution was to extend hospitality to people that I know, because I don't ever have friends over because I'm cooking for other people all the time. So I'm having friends over tomorrow, but it's just striking to me. And these are people I've known forever. They're people that go to my church. They know me. Like, this isn't like some super novel idea, but they sort of are treating it like it's this really novel idea that they're coming to my house for dinner. And several of them are like, oh my gosh, I could never do that. I could never have 8 people over for dinner and cook something. You know, but you can. And we talked to you about, you know, starting small. You can just have somebody over for tea and cookies. You don't have to kind of start with a whole meal. But it takes time, and it takes energy, and it takes effort. And that is what none of us feel like we have in our culture now. Nobody has time.
Sure. A pithy comment could be, the Bible says practice hospitality because it takes practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
So back in Brazil before I came to America, I used to have a lot of meals with my family. I was also blessed to have a family that was all really united and we loved the meal time. And when I came here, it was just like, it was a dream to be at the college that I went to, where I was, and I was just like super surprised by everything that was around me, and I was like getting busy, just trying to take advantage of everything, just being close to the shiny new gear that I never used in my life. So I was like avoiding having meals with people. I was like, oh, if I am like in the line at Wendy's to get the best meal ever, if I see someone, I pretend I don't see them, like, eat by myself and go to
keep going, yeah.
Something. And it turns out it was like one of the, like, I saw the how bad, how it was terrible for me. And one of the times that was the most difficult times of my life, the beginning of Berkeley, I really wanted all the time to go back to Brazil, and I just didn't feel connected. It took me a while to experience community, because I just, myself thinking I was, I'm here to live my vocation, and this is it, you know, and I forgot to, that my identity is also in others, and experience community, so this is all.
Awesome. It's that idea of having an integrated life, of having not just sort of this one sort of thing that's your life, but like Mickey was talking about, like we all are multifaceted, and God has made us to be whole for all those things to come together. And when we neglect certain parts, we feel it.
Yeah.
We feel it. Yeah, yeah. It's not neutral. Yeah.
Can I just ask a clarification question? Maybe I wrote it down wrong, but you said something about Jesus didn't come to make us into Christians, but to make us more fully human.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expound on that?
Yeah, I think that's just, so that's Hans Rittmacher.
Okay.
He was involved in the early part of Libri. And I think that's just getting at this idea, it's pushing back against the idea that being a Christian means sort of fitting in this particular form that's somewhat generic, and we have to kind of give up certain things to sort of toe the party line and have the formula work out, versus this idea of being fully human, of being having all these different parts of ourselves be present, be part of our human experience, but that's also part of what God welcomes in. And God isn't, you know, it's not just how many times a week do I go to church, do I go to Bible study, when do I pray, do I have Christian friends, am I only listening to Christian music, am I only watching Christian film? In that sense, that being able to live a much more holistic, integrated life.
I would say one of the challenges that I challenge myself with on that topic is we're told we believe we're supposed to be holy. Well, you know, we all have a certain, maybe you all have a certain picture of what it means to be holy, but few would deny that Jesus was holy, and whatever his holiness looked like, it was really attractive to sinners. And so I don't think that most Christians today think of holiness as something that attracts sinners.
Yeah.
And that's the sense of he made us to be more human, he made us to be more attractive to sinners, for people to be drawn to us. So if our idea of holiness doesn't include drawing people to us, we must be missing something.
He was the perfect human.
I think
our idea of holiness is something just really sterile.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. And that's but it infects us.
Mm-hmm.
It infects our thinking, our behaviors.
Yep.
So for Rittmacher, he liked to do sort of teasing ways of expressing things. And to him, being human meant being a Christian. And so it wasn't in a being
opposed.
All right, I'm Sarah. Just a little add-on. I can see I think that before. And then helped me for me to think. I don't think we mentioned it tonight about you don't have to just invite people to you. You can go to people and still be a hospitable person. And I'm thinking what you're saying. Being at college, and I'm thinking about my brother who's away, and he's a bit isolated and anxious and lonely, and he's only 2 hours away. And so I could just wait till he comes back home on break, or I could go to him and make him a meal and be with him there and help him in that way. So I think I mentioned Jesus going to track me as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jesus was in a lot of people's houses, for sure. I'm looking for my the Henry Nouwen book, Reaching Out, is great on that. Because when he talks about hospitality being an open and hospitable place where strangers can cast off their strangeness and become our fellow human beings. That's not just something that has to happen at a table. You know, kind of offering that space for people to be, that's also a space that just exists sort of in our relationships. And as we encounter, we can be hospitable to the person who's checking us out at the grocery store. And we can be hospitable to the bus driver. And we can be hospitable to, you know, I'm not only being hospitable if you're in my home or if I'm creating a physical space, that's part of it. But there's this other space that exists between us and other people that we can really manipulate and control and put our expectations on people, or we can really give them freedom to be who they are and for us to just be with. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Loving the stranger. Yeah.
Just kind of reinforcing what you're saying based on what I've been learning this week, mm-hmm. As far as part of what our job is as Christians is to reinforce people's dignity and the image of God and other people. And especially people who are not like us or marginalized or awkward or mentally ill or poor, that our job as Christians is the church is to reach humanize them in a way that we can imagine even when people can't see themselves, the image of God, and do that in a very visceral, physical way.
Totally.
It's like over, I hear you.
Mm-hmm. You have a place. You have a place here. You have a place. My church, I go to a larger church, so these things are possible there. But my church has a very robust ministry to people with special needs. And it's really awesome. They make a way for people, children, adults, with all kinds of special needs to participate in services, to be part of Christian education, whether it's a child who needs a one-on-one adult with them the whole time they're in the room, whether it's ways to participate in the service. It's really a beautiful thing, and it's something that I was involved with sort of in a previous life more directly, but it's something I get excited about whenever I see, because I think, that's just one of many groups of people who very much live on the margins. And I think, that our church has done a lot of work to make a place for them to be in. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I'm going to stop right there.
We just need to thank God for the rain.
Thank you, God, for the rain. Yeah. The earth matters.
Yeah.